Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
From a much warmer Tucson, good morning. Sirius 219 XM 201 Sports Zone 964. If you're listening to Sirius XM online and at our website too, stevebick.com and the University of Arizona Symposium on Racing and Gaming. I think officially we've changed it to just gaming. Is that Jake? Is that the...
Well, you know, actually, Steve, I'm looking over at the sign here, Global Symposium on Racing, and certainly gaming is a huge part of that.
It used to be both gaming and racing, and you know, after you say it for 10 years, or 45 in the case of veterans that have been coming forever, it gets stuck in your head. And things like, you know, the New York Racing and Wagering Board, they changed to the Gaming Commission.
True.
So after a certain period of time, when you've been saying the Racing and Wagering Board forever, you have to make that adjustment. Well, we've made an adjustment because the seasonability here in Arizona has improved markedly after getting here on Sunday and being rather taken aback. I've come here four times, and I was a little shocked that I had to pull out the vest and the quilted barn coat. It seems like a much nicer and more typical morning here in Tucson. Joined by Jacob Shepherd. And what class are you in?
Sure. So I am a first year racetrack program student on the business track. I'd like to be a bloodstock agent one day.
Interesting. Where are you from?
Originally Indiana, and I have a bachelor's degree from the University of Kentucky. This is my second go-around in college.
Interesting. And you know, this is something we encounter every time we come, and every time we talk to students at the University of Arizona. They're not necessarily coming in as matriculating freshmen out of high school. There's a lot of people that get either a hint that they are interested in the game, and after they start school down one path and maybe even start careers and lives, they basically turn on a dime and come back around and get involved in the program. And think about, I mentioned yesterday, Scott Little and Joe Longo, most notably, Steve May. And in fact, Steve May and Scott Little, they got involved. They got involved in the program because they heard about it on the show.
Oh, great.
Which is pretty funny.
Yes.
And then they ended up, and of course, Steve, regulator in Kentucky. Where in Indiana did you grow up?
A little south of Indianapolis in a town called Franklin.
I know Franklin.
Yeah.
I lived in Cincinnati. And
oh, great.
Went out with a girl from Columbus.
And, oh, sure.
Used to travel in that arena. And in fact, in an earlier cantation, used to, you're probably too young for this, Danners 3D, remember Danners?
Faintly.
You must have
it
been a little
a
kid. Yeah, it was like a Woolworth or a Kmart, and used to call on them in Indianapolis. And anytime Indy comes up, we put in the Big Shapiro's push.
Oh,
which is the greatest.
Corned beef.
The greatest. Unbelievable. And as I always have to add, not good corned beef and good delicatessen for the Midwest, good for anywhere, out of this world, kosher cafeteria.
Yes.
On South Washington.
Yes. A must before you go to a Pacer or Colts game.
If you have to do that, exactly, if you have to go down to Market Square, and boy, really showing our age when we're pulling out Market Square arena. Holy cow! Did you have any racing connection? I mean, what was your tie to the game?
Sure. So, my father was really interested in the game, but he is a social worker. And so, you know, we would watch the Kentucky Derby together, and we would often go down to Central Kentucky during spring breaks. And I really got into the game. He was kind of thinking about getting into it with a partner of his. And eventually we actually purchased a farm there in Franklin and raised a few foals that we would sell at auctions.
How about that?
Yeah. Kept a few to race, and we did that for about 10 or 12 years. And wow. Yeah, still kind of, you know, own a share here and there of some runners. So, yeah.
Well, and you got in at a good time in terms of the upswing and the basic burgeoning of the Indiana bred program and Indiana racing in general.
Absolutely. Those free Breeders Awards checks, well, you know, not well, exactly
they're
free.
They're
but...
free except for the hundreds of thousands of dollars that that you lose on any number of reasons.
That was really great, and that was really an important thing to us. We would have the Indiana bred that we would then take to Kentucky auctions, as a registered Indiana bred to support the Indiana bred program.
We talk all the time about the importance and the value and the elements of state bred programs,
of course,
and it. You know, not only obviously from a business standpoint, but when it comes to the product on the racetrack and what it, the versatility it offers the racing office and, the way that they can augment, especially places like Indiana and like Ohio. And if you've got a vibrant state bred program, and if you've got, in the case of those two areas, you got gaming that has contributed to the underpinnings, and the green space and all the things that are good about breeding and the raising of horses, the care of horses, it all comes into play. And the fact with all the students we've talked to over the years, it's the first time I've heard someone designate an interest in the bloodstock trade as the goal.
Sure.
And from that standpoint, how does the program here, how did it augment what you studied at Kentucky, and what side, when you got your undergrad, what side of the degree program at Kentucky did you study?
Sure. So that was actually, I studied agriculture communications at UK, and that was actually more for local food production. I read a lot of Wendell Berry and
interesting.
Yeah, eventually worked for the Lexington Farmers Market there for a couple of years. What I really liked about the U of A program, in terms of the bloodstock side, is kind of the form and function of the racehorse. I am a pedigree nerd from top to bottom.
Nice.
I love that aspect of it, but I felt like I needed a little more training and, kind of what to look for, reproduction and other kinds of aspects of that side of the industry. And I thought Arizona was the perfect place for that, and I'm really loving what I'm doing right now.
And from a coursework perspective, you must have to balance, some of the students here, we talk about the ones that are on the training track and moving toward working with the horses versus the ones that are on a business track. But for you, it's almost a parallel track because there's as much about husbandry and about, those elements on the racehorse side as there is benefit to, the business portion of just the financials and the dollars and cents of how whether it's a pinhook transaction or the care of broodmare bands and everything that goes into the maintenance of that elements of the program.
Very true. One of the things that I've really been interested in is kind of the fluctuations in stud fees. And especially kind of value stallions that you can get for, $12,000 or below, which really works for, our Indiana bred program.
That's a fabulous topic. And when we work with and have conversations weekly with Sid on Pedigree Focus presented by Hillendale, I love diving in and finding, those type, the stallions that, might have been blue collar racehorses. And it seems invariably that those that elevate, they seem to all come from a certain mold of typically a sprinter that was particularly sound and hard knocking. And you look at some of the ones that then, you know, kind of get introduced, whether it's in Florida or whether it's even in a smaller program, New York and you know, some of the other wherever they might be coming from. And you think about the Wildcat Airs, and Disco Rico and Cantheros most recently. They all seem to come from Poseidon's Warrior. In fact, we had Butchie Reed yesterday, in fact, speaking of Poseidon, thinking of Poseidon's Warrior. They all seem to come from that origin. It's,
if I may, Adios Charlie would
Adios
be in
Charlie,
that,
another
would
good
be in that
one.
Mold, I
absolutely
would say.
Absolutely. That they seem to pop up too out of nowhere. And you know, when Sid and I talk about this, we're always watching. And years ago I used to do it with the pedigree and sales conversations with the Glenny Kane Oakford. And you get hints. You see hints in the weanling, you know, first when the first crop of weanlings get offered, and then you get the short yearling sales at the beginning of the year, and you can tell, and particularly with certain, you know, bloodstock connections, and you watch the transactions and the buyers, and you see, you know, people you respect buying stallions that really were coming into their first crop without a lot of notoriety.
Sure.
And it's a really interesting element of that part of the trade. I'm tickled that you like that side, because I've just got kind of the casual. I just find it fun and fun to talk about, and you know, my questions to people like Sid are always kind of wide eyed, and it the ideas of the things that pop in my head, or I assume, you know, anybody that is not a specialist in the area are thinking, you know, those same kinds of things. And so when you say pedigree nerd, I surprised myself years ago when I was becoming a serious horse player, and I found myself being drawn in as well. And, you know, trying to read old anything about breeding, and because it caught my interest too. I mean, and nobody knows what they're looking at when they start out.
That's true. You develop an eye, and that's one of the things that I'm doing here at U of A. You know, you go to the ATBA sale and look at those prospects.
The Arizona sale, and that brings up a great question about mentoring. Who are you? You know, who's helping you, and what are you doing for interning and summers away? And because obviously, you know, finding somebody to you know, tag along with. In fact, we're going to talk to John Green from DJ Stable in just a little bit.
Oh, fantastic,
John! You know, he and his father and the DJ team, they operated in all of those arenas.
That's actually a family I've really looked up to. I see a lot of parallels actually between our family and theirs. I had a chance to meet them at the Breeders' Cup when we went there. You know, Steve, to kind of answer your question, you know, that's kind of what I'm working on at the moment. You know, I've reached out to a few folks to see about an internship next summer at a breeding farm in Kentucky, or you know, one of our farms in Indiana as well.
When you think about being a bloodstock agent, is there a segment, a specialty within it that you envision as a starting point?
Sure, it would probably be purchasing of broodmares. You know, the direct yearling to racing is still a little intimidating, you know, especially because there can be, you know, such a risk and reward with buying yearlings and then moving them to the racetrack. So, you know, kind of buying the factory, you know, purchasing a broodmare, you know, and then kind of deciding what to do there with the foal and who to breed that mare back to. That's really interesting, and I think that's probably where I have the most insight right now.
Could you envision, you know, working for a consigner, or what, you know, where in the you know, the landscape, it seems like a viable entree?
Sure. You know, you know, perhaps selling stallion seasons, you know, and being able to, you know, kind of relate.
Working for a big farm.
Probably. You know, working kind of that direction. You know, we're also even just kind of being my own bloodstock agency, selling stallion seasons, advising, you know, and even purchasing mares of my own.
How old are you?
37.
37?
Yes, sir.
That's I wouldn't have.
I appreciate it, Steve.
That's unbelievable. I figured you know mid late 20s, and that's amazing.
Thank you.
And so what? Wow. So what pushed you over the edge to come to Arizona? You fit the Scott Little, you know, to some degree you fit the Steve May, Scott Little, Joe Longo.
Scott and I have spoken about this a couple of times. You know, I was working at an LED startup company in the Bay Area of California, and that was going really well. The company was moving to Reno, Nevada, and we had an opportunity to come down here, and here I am. I'd been missing racing. I had taken a lot of my friends to Golden Gate Fields and, you know, kind of other, you know, horse-related activities up in the Bay Area, and I kind of thought, you know, this is a hobby. I love it. Let's go to Arizona. Let's make this a career.
Good for you. It's tremendous. Family, married, anything on those lines?
I am married, yes, sir.
See, this is important. And for those that are listening, that out of the page from Steve May and Joe Longo and Scott Little, that had obligations and had financial, you know, foundation to have to maintain. You need the support of spouse and so forth. I mean, it's got to be an interesting discussion. How readily did Mrs. Shepherd sign on?
I am very lucky.
All right. Good for you. Good job.
She knew that this was something I had been considering for a while, and you know, fortunately, she's in a position where moving to Tucson wasn't going to be a huge problem, and we made the move.
How about that? That's tremendous. That's great.
Thank you.
I love it. Jacob Shepherd joining me off the start of the show to talk about being at the University of Arizona, the racetrack industry program, and proving, because we'll hear from a number of students today and tomorrow, and we'll interject around other conversations. All ages, all backgrounds, some that you know that came right, you know, off the racetrack or out of the industry in some way, shape, or form, and all, you know, all different shapes, sizes, ages, and backgrounds. It's got to be the most unique college program that maybe anywhere in the country. There's nothing quite like it.
It's really fascinating. I love explaining it to friends and family. I like to call it the Harvard of horse racing.
Well, and of course, it doesn't hurt. You know, it doesn't hurt to have the wraparound of a state university the size of an Arizona.
Of course.
This works within within a. But now I'm going to forget which because it changed a couple of years ago. The department that oversees the racetrack industry program, Matt Hegarty, Mr. Arizona. of course, Matt, another.
I will be eating lunch with Matt during the mentor lunch on Wednesday.
Very nice. You couldn't do better than Matt, who, of course, is from Arizona and came here and then has covered the industry, the business side of the industry for his whole professional life, the daily racing form. The university has, you know, such great resources that
yes.
it makes it, you know, it makes it possible to operate a, you know, a program like this with you know, anywhere from 40 to 60 students on it on any given time.
The program and the university are incredibly generous with scholarships and making it accessible for you to come. That was one of the important things for me to decide to come. And, you know, also there's resources outside of class and, you know, they're here for you, I've found.
Well, and your path and your journey, it's always fun to come here and meet students. I meet new ones every year and then, you know, see them out in the industry from that point on. And so excited for you, and I always find it inspiring to, you know, see people that want to do something that is a passion, and they aren't, you know, they aren't afraid. I mean, it's intimidating, but it should encourage anybody that has, you know, this kind of an inclination and this thought that, you know, this is something I want to do, and how do I do it? If it requires the education, this is the place.
Absolutely.
Jacob Shepherd, and the Twitter, you out there on Twitter?
I am at JS Pedigrees.
Ooh, nice. Nice. That's a good one. I love it. JS Pedigrees. Well, you'll be on the lineup, and we'll follow you, and I really appreciate the way to kick off the morning here.
Thank you, Steve.
Jacob Shepherd, and a new career direction with all the conversations we've had over the years. That's the first bloodstock related. There's been insurance, there's been regulator, there's been trainer, there's been you name it, bloodstock as well. So as you can see, doesn't matter what your interests are. And we'll hear from more students as the morning and these 2 days at symposium go forward. We'll catch up with Wendy Davis and Denise Ferris, Liz Bracken, and Betty Prewitt, of course, who do just an unbelievable job just administering this program. And things get underway fairly shortly. They're having some breakfast right now, and we'll hit on a few of the topics. We're going to basically continue along a business front, and also the racing side too, because John Green, as we mentioned, is going to join us by phone, and the success of DJ Stable goes back decades. John's father, Len Green, of course, has had, I mean, just decades of success. And every area, racing, breeding, pin hooking, you name it, they've done it. And, of course, they're heavily involved in the financial management portion as well with the Green Group. John's got his own separate financial services interests, but he is the general manager of DJ. You could talk to the Greens about, I don't know, we could start with Song and a Prayer going back a few years. And in fact, Song and a Prayer came up yesterday because he's the broodmare sire of Maximus Mischief.
Indeed.
But Jaywalk, your Breeders' Cup Juvenile Filly winner, is just the latest big on-track success for DJ Stable. And, of course, partnered with Chuck Zachney's Cash is King. We'll talk to John Green after the first break. Later, Andy Serling. We'll get a visit in with Andy because I do want to... Andy said, asked me this morning, he said, do you need me today? He said, are you involved in Arizona stuff? I want Andy because Saturday was pretty tricky, a tricky read in terms of the racetrack and how it played. So we'll get Andy's thoughts on that, those performances, the stake winners. We obviously talked to the two-year-old portion of it yesterday with Rudy Brissett and Butchie Reed. But we'll talk a little pattern recognition, who, if he's going to stay sound, is going to be a major, major player going into next year. And also Marley's Freedom as well, who looks to stretch out and become a distaffer and expand her horizons beyond Philly and Mare sprinting. So Andy Serling, Eric Hamelbeck, and then a bunch of the students will be through as well this morning. We're at the symposium. There he is, the one and only Sheets. Take a break. Come right back. John Green joins us right after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
DRF Sports Form Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sports Form delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsform. Enter code DRF Sports.
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Do you want unlimited access to handicapping without exorbitant prices? Then BrizNet.com has you covered with a variety of plans for past performances, pedigree, and raw data. The BrizNet.com Performance Plan offers unlimited PDF past performances for just $75 per month and is available at BrizNet.com/PP. American Produce Records Online puts the pedigrees of nearly 1 million dams and more than 2 million foals at your fingertips, plus sire stats, for only $275 per year and is available at BrizNet.com/APR. The BrizNet.com data plan offers unlimited access to race day data files, perfect for handicappers with their own database or to plug into other people's programs. The data plan is just $125 per month. Visit BrizNet.com for all this information and more, and discover why BrizNet.com is the handicapper's edge.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing, this is At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Maybe I'm foolish, maybe I'm blind, thinking I can see through this and see what's behind. Got no way to prove it, so maybe I'm lying. But I'm only human after all. I'm only human after all. Don't put your blame on me. Don't put your blame on me.
We're back at the races.
Look in the mirror, what do you see?
And the students are filing in. They, of course, handle all the responsibilities around the symposium, and that includes the registration desk and so forth. They're all ready to go, and a little quiet still here this morning for about another half hour, and then things will start to really pick up. And 8:30, sessions kick off, and before they do, want to reach out and connect with John Green. And John, of course, and his father, Len, DJ Stable, that has been really ubiquitous in the sport. You see their name on the racing end. They've won a couple thousand races over the years. The breeding side, and whether it's horses that they home breed and race, or that have gone out as sales turnover. We mentioned Song and a Prayer, notably, and yesterday, Maximus Mischief. Speaking of two-year-olds, the most recent success that brings DJ into the spotlight, Jaywalk, the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Filly winner, and the leading Eclipse candidate for Juvenile Filly. John Green, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you doing out in the West Coast?
Excellent. And this has really become, third out of 4 years. And it's always encouraging, given how difficult the business is and the atmosphere and all the challenges that the industry faces, you come here and it'll give you a good feeling because you see the students you see how enthusiastic they are and what they're looking forward to and being involved in the game and the industry long term, and it's really heartening. And in fact, you and the Green team invoked with our first guest is Jacob Shepherd, who wants to be in the bloodstock side and admires what you guys have accomplished.
Well, it's certainly been a great run in just a phenomenal industry. And actually, before we get into the horse side of it, from one Patriot League graduate to another, I wanted to wish you good luck this weekend against North Dakota State. I'm only a couple of years younger than you, so I was at Lehigh when we ran the run and shoot, and we would always look forward to going up to Hamilton to play you guys. It's just been a great run, and we're excited, again, as a fellow Patriot Leaguer, to see you guys on ESPN this weekend.
Well, I appreciate that, and in fact, this is a big day for. I hadn't thought about it until you said that, but and I knew you went to Lehigh because you're on the Lehigh alumni board, and
correct.
It's a big day for engineers, and if you graduated in my era, you refused to call them Mountain Hawks. Andy Serling is next, so it's the Lehigh exacta of you and Andy.
Well, that's quite an honor to be considered in that genre. I'll tell you, I took as you said, the engineers plus 41 against your Red Raiders this year and lost that bet because I think we got trounced. So we are looking forward to you guys moving along, so that way we can kind of lick our wounds and say, well, at least we lost to a great team.
Well, it's going to be a challenge. I was waiting for that line to come out yesterday, and Johnny D was very conservative. He said 10. It opened at 26.5.
20. Yeah, I was going to say about four touchdowns. Yeah,
but it dropped. It's dropped down to 21. And curiously, the over under is 41. And
really,
okay. Yeah, I thought that the right now the thing to take is the over because that seems a conservative number. Colgate's got some trouble, including Wisniewski being out, which is not that's a very, very bad element. His speed on the defense is going to be really missed. So I don't know. It doesn't bode well. But it was fun to be there on Saturday, John. I can tell you that.
No question about it. Well, speaking of handicapping, what is your insight on the handicapping of the two-year-old Eclipse Awards? Because it looks like it's going to be close this year.
It will be, and I expect that Jaywalk deserves it. And I have been an absolute vocal proponent of considering the turf side. And that started with Lady Eli and Rushing Fall as well. But that came in years, at least from my vantage point, that you had kind of questionable candidacies on the dirt side. There's no questionable, nothing questionable about the candidacy of Jaywalk, not winning the races that she did, en route. Her body of work absolutely is worthy, and it's not like people need to go looking for something as an alternative.
Right. And you know, it's amazing because as the years go on and we've been in the business, you know, close to 30 years now, and you look at some of the horses that we've owned over the years, and you've mentioned them in the prelim, you know, we've been very fortunate. We've had, you know, a number of graded stake winners. We had Do It With Style in 91 winning the Ashland, and that was really exciting, but it was such early on in our racing career that we didn't really appreciate it. We just thought, oh, okay, this is the way things work. You get a nice filly, you run against Meadow Star, then you run in the Ashland, and you win, and you go to the Oaks, and we'll just brush, rinse, and repeat next year. And it's been, you know, 20 plus years since we've had a Grade One filly of this caliber. So I'm pleased to hear that you're looking at it the way we're looking at it, which is, you know, Jaywalk really represents the top two-year-old filly in the country right now.
Get into your background and your father's involvement and how, you know, what the origins were, because nobody you know, jumps into it. Although we did talk about Stonerside last week with the passing of Mr. McNair, and it seemed like it was a seed was planted, and 10 minutes later there was this far flung operation that had success. What were the origins? And for you, because you've got to be close to 50, when did you start to, you know, really understand what you were going to end up being involved in?
You know, that's a great question. We started getting involved in racing about, like I said, about 30 years ago, when a neighbor of ours brought us to Monmouth Park, and Monmouth Park is literally 7-8 miles from where I grew up, you know, here in Holmdel, New Jersey. And we went when I was about 9 or 10 years old. We watched a $5,000 claimer, which to us didn't mean anything. It was, you know, it was just a horse in a race, and we got to go into the paddock and watch the pageantry and meet the jockey, and sure enough, the horse won. And I remember very distinctly, you know, driving home with my parents from Monmouth Park, and my dad turned around, I was in the back seat, and said, "Well, what'd you think?" And you know, as a young kid, I got a hot dog, and I got to watch a race and go in the winner's circle and cash a $2 win ticket. I mean, it was nirvana for me. It couldn't be better. And I remember, you know, saying, "Wow, that was really great." And my dad said, "Yeah, and you know, imagine what we can do if we really run this as a business." And my dad's background is in taxation, and he is a tax specialist. He's an accountant by trade, and loves to get involved in some of the intricacies of the tax code, which sounds counterintuitive, like who would want to read the tax code? But he looks at it as a challenge, almost like when you look at the racing form and you're trying to find, you know, that anyone can bet on the favorite, but if you find a golden nugget, a 6-7-8-1 shot, all of a sudden, you know, I've heard you on your show before, you get excited about stuff like that when you see things that other people don't see. So we took about 2 years before we even invested in the industry, and researched it and talked to people in the business and really tried to run it as a business, more so than just as a, oh, this will be fun to go to the races and kind of pet noses you know, and entertain people at Monmouth Park. And that slowly evolved to where we started investing. We bought some claimers. A couple years later, we were third in the country in wins, and then we followed up that with two more years of being in the top five in wins. And Steve, it got to the point where we were winning races, and it was phenomenally fun and exciting. And I was at Lehigh at that point, and was traveling back and forth from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, to Bensalem, Pennsylvania, to watch our horses run. And we sat down and said, "It's great that we're winning these races, but we're way in the hole, and this isn't the way that businesses should be run." So we kind of took a step back and spoke to more people who were really influential in the business, and rejiggered our game plan to you know, to where we are now, which is less is more. You want to have more quality and less numbers, because really that the top end of the market is where you want to be if you have a chance to make money in the business.
How quickly along that learning curve and that cycle did the bloodstock side start to take root, and the you know, the acquisition of broodmares and then getting into, you know, the business from sale and pinhook and all the, you know, all those pinnings?
I think, you know, that's a great question. It was an evolution over a number of years, but what really solidified it is we had a claiming operation, and when the fillies were being retired, we were breeding them. And what we were finding is that, you know, when you breed claiming horses to not great stallions, the genetics of it simply state that you're not going to have very good luck. So we scrapped it, and we literally, you know, had grown to almost 50 or 60 broodmares, and if I tell you that each one of them was worth $1,000, I'm probably exaggerating. And we revamped it and got rid of all of them, and basically said, we're going to buy better horses. We're going to breed the better horses, and our first foray at it was very fortunate. We bred three mares to a newly retired horse named Stormcat, and those three mares ended up producing November Snow, who was the Eclipse Award winner, Senate Appointee, who was the Canadian 3-year-old champion. And then another filly that we sold as a foal for over $500,000. So, you know, that really opened our eyes to say, hey, this is the way to go, is down this path with breeding the better horses. And again, just to take a step back, I'm a financial planner by trade, and we invest people's money in a number of different, you know, blue chip stocks. You know, where we're building kind of their own mutual fund. And we basically took the same approach to the horses and said, you know, let's buy blue chip mares, blue hen mares. Let's breed to better horses. And what we found is that the marketplace then takes hold, and a horse that may be worth 100 all of a sudden is worth 125, 150, not because it's any better looking at that point, but because the people who are bidding on it can afford to make that extra $25,000, $50,000 bid.
The decision making process, and, you know, then picking offspring, you know, we talk to people that. I think about a conversation we had earlier this year with Watts Humphrey, and you know, we think about a breeder like that keeps the fillies and sells the colts. What's your commercial approach, and how does, you know, how does being in the, virtually every marketplace, meaning broodmare bloodstock sales in the fall and winter, and short yearlings and pinhooking, and, you know, you're involved in every single step along the way, and what influences you in the decision-making process on what to sell and what to keep?
You know, and that's an annual discussion that we have internally with my mom and dad, you know, who add their value and their insight into what we're doing. Steve, I would say that even though this is, you know, the equine industry, you really have to rely on the human aspect of it, in the sense of you have to have people who are involved in it every day. And you know as well as I do that this industry is an unregulated industry. So it's really difficult to know, you know, who's wearing the white hats and who's wearing the black hats. And once you can get a team around you of people that are honest and trustworthy and have good insight, then you take their advice and you listen to them and you question, you know, certain things about them, and then you go with, you know, with their recommendations. And I think that's what's really evolved over the past 20 plus years, is that we've been able to kind of vet out the people that we don't want to work with or that don't have, you know, the best intentions for our program. And you keep people in there that are trustworthy and intelligent and hardworking, and then, you know, they give you advice. And it's silly for me to think that I can sit here at a desk in New Jersey and understand the, you know, everything that goes on with our horses in Kentucky or our horses in Florida without being there on a day-to-day basis. So you have to entrust them. And then, you know, we look at business trends and we look at market trends. And it used to be, you could breed, you know, foals and have them be solid book three athletes and make some money on each horse and do well. And now we're seeing the industry trends changing where you really have to have a book one pedigree, because if the horse is going to, in this case, if a yearling is going to jump through all the hoops of looking the part and being commercial and vetting and being, you know, and peaking at the right time, any horse that goes into the sale, yearling sale, has to, you know, jump through all those hoops. So if you can afford to do it where you have a better bred horse, then every time they jump through a hoop, it exponentially increases their value. And I know that was kind of a long-winded answer to your question, but it's really a bunch of those components that go into our calculations.
Out of curiosity, in that decision-making portion, and it's the time of year where brood mares will be delivering in just a few weeks, and the final decisions will be made on stallion matings.
Yep.
What percentage, John, do you find that you make decisions that I think if we talked about them as wagers, we think about prime bets and action bets and splitting
right.
the bankroll, taking a chance on some maybe lower priced new stallions and taking a couple of swings on being out in front of a trend.
Right. Yeah. And that's actually, you know, Steve, that's what we look at all the time. So basically, I'm going to keep the math easy because I'm a Lehigh grad. I'm not a Colgate grad, so I get to keep math easy, okay? And let's say we have 21 mares. What we usually do is we will take 7 of them and breed them to the top of the market. So we're breeding them to Uncle Mo and Tappet and horses of that caliber. We're taking a third of the mares and we're breeding them to horses that used to be at the top of the market, but for whatever reason, maybe have had one or two colder crops, and of late, that's Tisnow and Bernardini, for example. So still great names, but just for whatever reason in the marketplace, they've been discounted a little bit. And then we'll take a third of the group and we'll breed them to newer stallions. And it's not just first-year stallions, because everybody wants to breed, you know, to Nyquist a couple of years ago, and everyone wants to breed to Liam's Map, and this year everyone wants to breed to Good Magic. So those are ones that are really in hot demand. What we'll do is we'll also look at horses that were standing a couple of years ago. We've looked at their yearlings and thought very highly of their yearling crop, and feel like this is a good candidate for us to place a bet, as you said, and invest some money into a third or fourth year stallion with the hopes that you're going to catch lightning in a bottle and they're going to have a really big first crop, like Cross Traffic did this year.
And that includes, and obviously a great example with the Jaywalk, and you know, we talk often and hear about that make or break third crop and the opportunity to, you know, kind of look around the corner and see who, you know, may have just been a little unlucky for whatever reason. Steve Haskin always talks about John Nayrud's philosophy about, you know, not making a determination on a stallion until they've had 7 crops, and that's the only at that point can you make a decision. So this is an interesting philosophy, and anybody that plays any kind of fantasy sports can identify with all three of those. You know, devoting a portion of the bankroll, you know, to the elite players, and then maybe what they call past post-hype types,
right,
that you know, that are you know, undervalued because they had been overvalued. That's great. I'm glad I asked that, because I that's a perfect perfect way to look at it, splitting it up a third, a third, a third.
Yeah, and that's just through our analytics over the past few years of doing it that way. And you know, in previous years, the numbers were a little bit different, but it wasn't until a couple of years ago where actually Bill Betts, where we have some of our brood mares in Kentucky at that thoroughbred, and we had a couple of mares that we just weren't sure we were going to keep. And basically, you know, we went to him and said, Bill, what do you do with these mares that are kind of on the bubble, where you're not sure if you're going to keep, and depending on how this in utero foal looks, we may put it into the November sale next year. And he actually tipped us off to his philosophy of that, and we tweaked it a little bit. But I give him full credit for that analysis. And again, Steve, it goes back to, you have to keep your mind open in this business, because there are so many different ways to skin a cat, whether it's what you mentioned before with Watts Humphrey, or, you know, where Darby Dan, you know, their philosophy was, we're going to really double down on very few number of female lines. And that way, if a filly does well in that family, it shows up in five or six different pedigrees. So it exponentially increases the entire herd. And that's a different way of looking at it, but you still have to take notice, because they've been successful, you know, for 50, 60 years doing that. So I think everyone, as long as you come into it with an open mind, there's a lot of programs that do a great job of year in and year out making money. It may not be flashy and splashy, but every year they come up with good horses, you know, on the racetrack, and good horses in the auction ring.
When it comes to acquisition, because you're just as apt to you know, buy in, you're partnered up with any number of people in pinhooking ventures. Discuss that aspect and what you have hit on as a successful formulation for an approach to it. And you know, one of the things that's amazing to me is the explosive success of the weanling pinhook market, which didn't exist
right
20 minutes ago.
It really didn't, and you know, you hit it on the head. If you look at the analytics of the weanling average versus stallion's yearling average, they're almost identical. So, you know, you sit there and say, okay, well, dollar for dollar, I personally would rather own a yearling over a weanling for the same price, because they're so much further along in their development, and there's less risk at that point. But you're right, so many people now are taking advantage of selling weanlings, or, you know, they're selling their horses as weanlings and getting top dollar and getting their money back that much sooner and taking some risk off the table. With regard to your question, though, you know, we've been very fortunate in partnering up with really good people. And I think that part of it stems from the fact that, again, I'm going to go back to the business part of it. You know, my dad has the Green Group up here in New Jersey that specializes in taxation and really has a niche in the horse industry. And I think they have over 300 clients that are in the horse industry that are clients of theirs. And then my partners and I here in the financial planning world at Targeted Financial, we have about 50 or 60 clients that are in the horse industry. So, you know, you can really see what goes on with people's programs when you manage the money and when you do their taxes, that they're almost, you know, that they're almost willing to share with you their most intimate secrets. And once you see that they're doing things the right way, then, you know, philosophically, you feel more comfortable giving them money and investing with them. And that's what we've been able to do over the past few years, is, you know, especially on the pinhooking side.
Since you mentioned both your business and Green Group, which is your father's, explain the client base and who kind of differentiate the services, because you've got virtually people in every, from every capacity in the game. And obviously, when you're spending as much time in all of these different facets, you're going to come in contact with all those different kinds of people. But you've got trainers and jocks and breeders and owners that are your clients. You mentioned 50, 60, and the Green Group. Talk about the Green Group's interaction, because actually, the name has become a little bit more kind of out front. I see, I know some either some sponsorships, or, you know, I've seen the
right
Green Group attached, I think maybe at Phasing. Explain the two companies.
Yeah, and thank you for that opportunity. So Dad's firm, the Green Group, obviously has been in the taxation world for as long as Dad's been a professional. So I'm going to say, you know, 50 to 55 years. And when he got involved in the horse business, when we all got involved in the horse business, he really took a look at the tax code and wanted to specialize in it. And then after a few years, felt confident enough that he was well-versed in that sector. And then we started to promote to people in the industry, just how tax advantageous things were in the business and just how they could save money on taxes and therefore reinvest the money into the horses. And over a number of years, I got more involved in the investment portion of people's businesses. And instead of, instead of having them invest in the horse business, we were able to, prove to them that there's a rationale to actually invest in the stock market. And the funny thing, Steve, about it is most people in the horse business see the stock market as a crazy, volatile business. And you sit there and you scratch your head and you say, yeah, but most people think the horse business is a crazy volatile business. But through that niche of knowing the horse industry as well as we did and adding value, and then people saw that we were successful in the horse business, and it just became a natural evolution that they said to themselves, okay, if these guys know their stuff on investments and on tax benefits in the horse industry, then we should reciprocate and let them save us some money and make us some money. And again, without giving names out, what you saw is, with my firm at Target Financial, we started focusing on pinhooking operations, so groups that were down in Ocala and South Carolina. And at one point, I think it was last year, we actually managed money for 8 of the top 10 gross sales pinhookers. And I think there's a direct correlation because we were making them money in the investment world, and they were able to take that money and reinvest it into their own operations, and then they were able to make that extra bid to get that horse. So they were able to buy that extra horse. So they were able to put that extra money into their own facility and have it be a better racetrack, which therefore would enable them to draw, more owners. So I think it's just been a great partnership that we've had with our clients, where we've been able to make them and save them money, outside of the horse industry, and they've taken that and reinvested it and also made money on the equine side.
It's interesting because your father has been, out in front at a lot over the years at any number of conferences and as a keynote speaker, and his expertise that he offers to people very generously. I want to talk about something that you've been very generous with. Tell people about Jeremy's Heroes.
Well, thank you. Jeremy's Heroes is a nonprofit that actually my sister runs, my sister Debbie, who is the D in DJ, and she never lets me forget that she has top billing in DJ, by the way. Jeremy's Heroes is named after Jeremy Glick, who was one of the passengers on the flight that went down on 9/11, and he was one of the individuals who famously took on the terrorists. And in the movie about it, he was one of the four or five individuals who yelled, "Let's roll!" and actually fought back against the terrorists and made the plane crash in Pennsylvania versus its original destination, which was the White House and the Pentagon. So, the money that's raised from that organization goes back into schools that don't have gym programs or athletic programs, and just gives students an opportunity to have after-school activities and exercise activities to keep them of sound mind and sound body.
Very nice. Very nice.
So I thank you for bringing that up.
Not at all. How can people learn more about Jeremy's Heroes?
People can learn more, absolutely, by going to jeremysheroes.org. Or you can just, if you just Google Jeremy Glick, and look for the nonprofit organization named after him. And that's been in existence for 17 years now. It's hard to believe that it was just that long ago that the world kind of went on its ear after 9/11. But we feel like that we've generated some real goodwill and some great programs you know, for the kids. And now some of the students are actually starting to graduate college and are giving back, you know, their time and efforts back into the program. So it's really starting to exponentially, you know, grow. And we just feel like that we're making a positive impact on the world, which, you know, as you know, because you donate time as well, that's what we're here for.
Well, positive impact as well on the industry in the decades that you and your father and the whole family have you know, dedicated and contributed. And I was looking forward to this, John, and was just looked on with a big smile at everybody except for Chuck Zachney, who was on his way back from Ireland when Jaywalk won at Churchill, and everybody was kind of looking around like, where's Chuck?
I'll tell you, one of the things, and I know we're up against a break, so I'll keep it short, but one of the things about this business is you meet such wonderful people, and Chuck was somebody that we hadn't even met 3 years ago. And John Service suggested that we sit down with Chuck and meet him because he thought that it would be a good fit personality-wise, which it's been. And he's just such a great, unassuming individual, and just wants what's best for the horses and for the people involved. And his mantra really is, you know, be in the moment, enjoy the moment, because so many times, you know, after a horse wins, you're immediately thinking about, well, where are we going next? What are we doing next? What's the next, you know, what's the next hurdle? And he, you know, he set out to have this trip in Ireland with his friends a long time ago, and to his credit, even though this is his love, he said, nope, I'm going to go to Ireland, and I'm going to, you know, honor that commitment, and you guys know how to win a race, so go ahead and get it done. And it's just been such a joy to get to know him as an individual and as a partner. And, you know, now I can announce on your show that we actually bought a piece of Lucky Lee, who's a flatter colt that John Service trains for Chuck, and we're going to be involved in that one as well. And hopefully, you know, he'll go on to greatness, just like Diamond King and Jaywalk have.
Well, you've had some good names, I was at Gulfstream, and I can't remember if it was when he broke his maiden when Mo Green won with Joe O. Alibi Breakfast makes me smile. That's a cute name, and that career oriented that seems to be coming along. You got a feeling like you've got a plethora of nice 2-year-olds, and the leader of the pack, the engine on the train right now, of course, Jaywalk, will, you know, continue toward January as the leading candidate for the 2-year-old Philly Eclipse. John, continued success. Happy Hanukkah to you and the girls, and we'll look forward to seeing you somewhere along the line soon, I'm sure.
I really hope so, Stephen. Thank you again for having me on. I really appreciate it. And hopefully I'll give you an excuse to have us on again, you know, as some of these horses continue to develop. But I can't thank you enough, and I hope to see you at the Eclipse Awards, you know, when Jaywalk is nominated.
This was a real pleasure, and John Green, DJ Stable, and his father's business, that the Green Group, that is very familiar, and as well as John's business, Target, and we'll put up you're on Twitter, right? What are you tweeting at?
Yeah, actually, you know, the best thing to do is if you look up Targeted Financial, that's our financial planning organization, and you know, again, it's just been such a joy to be able to have both the financial industry and the horse industry together. I'm a very lucky person. Aaron Yagoda is a good friend of both of ours, and he constantly says that I'm one of the luckiest guys in the world because I'm able to merge two loves, you know, into one existence, and you know, it's absolutely truth.
Well, and that's really the theme of being here at the University of Arizona. So many people that are trying to do just that, take a passion and something they love, and make it their life's work, and obviously you and your father are enjoying that as well. John Green, everybody. John, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Have a great week out there.
John Green. Let's take a break here. Top of the hour. as I said, the Lehigh grad exacta. Andy Serling joins us next.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
DRF Sports Form Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sports Form delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsform. Enter code DRF Sports.
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Do you want unlimited access to handicapping without exorbitant prices? Then BrizNet.com has you covered with a variety of plans for past performances, pedigree, and raw data. The BrizNet.com Performance Plan offers unlimited PDF past performances for just $75 per month and is available at BrizNet.com/PP. American Produce Records Online puts the pedigrees of nearly 1 million dams and more than 2 million foals at your fingertips, plus sire stats, for only $275 per year, and is available at BrizNet.com/APR. The BrizNet.com data plan offers unlimited access to race day data files, perfect for handicappers with their own database or to plug into other people's programs. The data plan is just $125 per month. Visit BrizNet.com for all this information and more, and discover why BrizNet.com is the handicapper's edge.